Hello, this is Lawrence White, professor of economics at George Mason University with the November 2015 Econ Journal Watch audio podcast. And our topic today is Venezuela, and we're going to discuss a contribution to our September issue by Hugo Faria and Leonor Filardo about the status of liberalism in Venezuela. The title is Venezuela Without Liberals, There Is No Liberalism. How are you, Professor Faria?
I'm fine, Dr. White. Living here in the United States, I had to flee the country.
So you are free to speak your mind, which is good for our listeners. But
yes.
Tell us about your decision to flee the country. How recently was that?
We came to the United States 2 years ago, exactly July 2nd, 2013. And, well, the reason was that my daughters had already left. I have one in Mexico, another one in New York, and another one here in Miami. My parents died in 2011. Well, my wife is a U.S. citizen. I have a green card. And there's no future down there. And in spite of, let's say, a major battle of ideas that we tried to bring on, and, well, to no avail. And then all really totally discouraged because... basically, our recommendations had no resonance among the leaders, political and entrepreneurial. So that, you know, said, well, this is enough for us to go to greener pastures. And, well, that's the main reason why then we decided to come here.
You mentioned at the beginning of your article that you and your co-author have written several books trying to spark some interest in liberal ideas in Venezuela. So what kind of reception did you get?
Well, it did get some visibility in the media, but it really did not generate much traction. In a sense, we were victims of the so-called conspiracy of silence, whereby people apparently agree, but after that, there is no action consistent with that agreement. So that was part of the sense of discouragement that we had and that my co-author also has.
So you go into the history of liberal ideas in Venezuela, and did Venezuela have a point at which it had a liberal political economy, or a sort of liberal center to the economic policy, or has it been illiberal all along?
Yeah, well, from the very beginning, the father of the nation, Simon Bolivar, he was actually, and it's in his writings, it shows very clearly that he had some antagonism towards the United States, and in particular towards the experiment the United States was undertaking, and always expressed some doubts about the capacity of the people to live and prosper in a free system. So from its very inception, then, as a nation.
What decade was that?
Oh, this is 1810, more or less, 1812,
okay.
1815, those years. Yeah. Well, so from the very beginning, then, we started on the wrong foot. And then, well, we had years of a lot of infighting and internal revolutions. And then around 1908 came an individual called Juan Vicente Gomez. Although he was definitely a ruthless dictator, he provided the underpinnings for the establishment of a capitalist economy to the extent that he pacified the country. He gave to Venezuelans a sense of being Venezuelans and not belonging to particular regions of the country. He exhibited a lot of fiscal discipline. He paid the debt. We had no currency that was forced on Venezuelans. In other words, we had more or less a system of monetary freedom, money issued by banks and backed by gold. We had, relatively speaking, low taxes. And he had the vision of bringing into the country the foreign oil companies, American and Europeans, to extract the newly found wealth. So that then instigated a period of sustained growth and prosperity. Although there were some measures taken that, in a sense, perhaps reflected that Venezuelans were not still totally aware that oil was a major transformation of the country and that, therefore, we had to think differently. In the sense that banks, development banks, were created to help agriculture, and part of it was because they saw that the oil was providing for a very strong currency, and therefore the famous Dutch disease. The point of the matter was that, in a sense, you know, we were trying like to square a circle. And of course, we've been all our lives then, at least since the 1920s and 30s, divided by this fact that we want to have oil, but at the same time, we want to have industry that really is not compatible with oil because it's simply in that environment, it's not sufficiently competitive.
Right.
And then that has led to a lot of devaluations and a lot of measures taken to try to help industries that are really not capable of surviving when you have a country that is basically driven by oil.
So protectionism became the policy of the government.
That's correct. That's one of those that were adopted. That's right. That's right. So and of course that never works. So instead of recognizing the new reality, instead of recognizing that there's been a creative destruction process that's taking place, and therefore trying to develop economic activity that is compatible with oil, and also trying to give people more ownership in the oil industry. We didn't do any of those things, and so that has created a permanent tension, a permanent conflict within the Venezuelan economy that, of course, has not provided for good results.
So when Gomez was in power, he had relatively free market policies, but he wasn't really supported in any way by popular opinion in that, or there wasn't understanding?
I'm sorry, there was any what?
Did the intellectuals understand the benefits of free markets?
Part of the main problem that we had in that respect was that the government was and is the owner of the oil well. So then the consequence of that is that no constituency was really homegrown in order to develop an interest or a defense for oil, and basically criticized a set of policies that were being adopted that were inefficient and that were not well providing for an efficient allocation of resources. There was no constituency for that. Basically, well, people saw that we had oil and in the hands of the government, so those inefficiencies were really never decried. And as a result of that, then we made too many of them, too many policies that resulted in an efficient allocation of resources. So
everyone
again,
was,
it's really...
Interest groups were competing for the oil wealth and dissipating
let's put it this way. Interest groups were, in a sense, competing for the oil wealth, anticipated in the sense that it was like trying to transfer all resources to their particular economic activities, which were not efficient. And you can see that in the agricultural sector, and also that can be also easily seen by the decision that we made in the 60s to go the protectionist way, and therefore generate a lot of economic activity that was really not competitive in the world. But all that, of course, was supported by oil.
I learned a couple of years ago that Venezuela was one of the last countries in the globe, really, to get a central bank, 1939. So I was hopeful that it was a liberal banking system up until that point. But you mentioned in the paper that Gomez created government development banks for workers, for home buyers, for farmers. So it was no longer just a free banking system.
It was free banking in the sense that there was a limitation to the money issued, and the money issued basically depended on gold or silver. But of course, that did not preclude from having the government create other banks that, with the intent of basically helping interest groups. So in that regard, it was not a totally free banking system, but in terms of the stability and protection of the fruits of the labor of the people, it was definitely a much better system than the one we have right now, which is really totally dysfunctional. Yeah.
So you mentioned in the paper that the central bank is created in 1939. In 1940, they slap on exchange controls to defend the currency. And exchange controls, as we know from many cases, tend to create other kinds of controls.
Right. Yeah, that never worked, and basically it was those exchange controls were implemented as a result of Second World War, so it was really an excuse to implement exchange controls, exchange rate controls, and later on they were lifted, and then during the Pérez Jiménez in the 50s dictatorship, the Bolívar had a good reputation internationally in the sense that everybody knew that it was fully backed by dollars, because the Central Bank of Venezuela initially really was what we call now a currency board.
Uh-huh.
And it stayed like that, and it was very solid and with a great reputation until Betancourt with the democracy, when the democracy started, that then he decided to implement, again, exchange controls, and also ended up devaluing the Bolivar. So so the point of the matter is that what I'm trying to convey is that I think that a system of monetary freedom and free banking, it beats a currency board. But a currency board is much better than than we started to introduce, which was basically allowing for a debasement of the Bolivar and also allowing for the central bank to lend directly to the executive branch.
So you mentioned
in the early...
Right. You mentioned a minute ago the current situation. So there have been exchange controls since Chavez came to power. And what's the situation now for someone in Venezuela who wants to move money?
Yeah. Right now it's really chaotic. The average Venezuelan has seen the international purchasing power of his salary has been basically totally dissipated. I mean, to the extent that we have professionals that could be, what I mean by professionals are individuals who have a university degree that can be earning like $30 or $40 per month. And of course, inflation is rampant. And well, I mean, right now the situation has really deteriorated into a total mess. And it's also important to indicate that in 1989, inflation went up to like 90%. And in 1996, that year went up like to 101, 102%. So what I'm trying to say is that, of course, right now it's a real mess. But prior to Chavez, we also had high inflation. And in that regard, the situation really started to deteriorate. It entered into a turning point in 1983 when the currency was devalued. Since that point, February 18th, 1983, it's been constant high inflation and high devaluation. And of course, it's your average Venezuelan, the one who suffers the most, the consequences of these policies that basically end up confiscating the hard-earned fruit of the labor of the people.
You have an interesting and somewhat depressing list in the paper of all the interventionist policies that were adopted between 1959 and 1999. And I guess the question this raises to me is, was there opposition to these policies? Were there economists or others in Venezuela who saw what this would lead to?
Yeah, there were some, but they were a minority. I would say that Nicomedes Zuluaga, who actually befriended a lot of notable Austrian economists, had this journal called Orientación Económica. And some of the economists that wrote there were essentially noting the major difference in policies that were being adopted during the democratic period as opposed to the ones that existed in the decade before during Pérez Jiménez. Well, I mean, it's one of these things that sometimes it's hard to believe, but those comments and those criticisms really, again, experienced somewhat the conspiracy of silence, and really nothing was done about it. And that's the story of many other decisions. Like, for example, when the government decided to nationalize the oil industry and the iron industry. There were some voices of opposition, but the vast majority of the people apparently saw that as a natural outcome. We're suffering the consequences of those decisions because up to, say, 1958, 1959, in spite of some deviations that existed in terms of economic policy, deviations, I mean, from a classical liberal paradigm, in spite of those deviations and then some outcries, we just continue that route. And it's important to point out those decisions because, as we state in the paper, and it's clearly documented, Venezuela is known as an economic growth disaster. And that's to distinguish from growth miracles. And this is prior to Chavez. So the point that I'm trying to make is that in order to convert, to go from a country that is a growth miracle, because we were growing at rates even higher than Germany, into a growth disaster, a lot of ill-conceived policies had to be implemented. And that's exactly what happened. And the worst part, let's say to add insult to injury, is that these things are occurring in an environment of relatively speaking, peace, a peaceful environment. I say this because, for example, Nicaragua is also a growth disaster. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two of Latin America. But Nicaragua had a civil war. That was not our case. Not only we didn't have a war, an internal war, but also we had very high oil prices, and therefore many variables that were favorable to have rapid growth. And in spite of that, we are known as a growth disaster because on average over those years, population growth exceeded production growth. In other words, the amount of people that were the growth of population, simply the growth of population exceeded real GDP growth.
So per capita GDP declines.
There you go. That's right. So that's why the growth rate of per capita GDP was negative on average over those years. That doesn't mean that there was no growth. After the onset of democracy, let's say the country experienced growth from 1960 until 1977, but at a rate much lower than the one we had been experiencing prior to the onset of democracy. And then from 1977, until at least 2009, which I know that this calculation has been extended, basically today's real GDP is lower than the one we had in 1977, GDP per capita.
That's remarkable.
Amazing. Amazing, but true.
The other South American case that's familiar to us of that sort of move from prosperity into lower income is Argentina, of course.
Two
parallels between Venezuela and Argentina in the state turning to so much rent seeking and redistribution that the economy suffered.
Familiar with the Argentinian case, but apparently it was driven by Perón, who was a very populist individual, I want to go a little bit further in the following sense, and it's that sometimes I think that there are maybe cultural factors, or even I don't know if there are genetic factors that. To which that includes the population to go along with policies of this sort. And I say this because, for example, let's look at Chile. Chile, actually with Pinochet and then after him, has experienced high growth. I would say, I know that this is not very politically correct, but I think that it's basically due to the policies initially implemented by Pinochet. In spite of that growth, in spite of the positive consequences of the growth, which is a major reduction in poverty, and now a lot of more people with a much better education, in spite of that, now we see that they have elected Bachelet, and she is even intent in changing the constitution, the Pinochet left. And apparently there is support for that. So, you know, when I see these things, I start thinking, well, I mean, what does it take for Latin American countries to adopt policies and live with those policies that have been successful and then not try to change them, and basically based on the paradigm of redistribution, which, you know, being very, 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 very sincere and frank, I think they're all rooted in envy. Yeah, because if the individuals, the entrepreneurs, are making their money in a correct way, increasing the welfare of others, and everybody's seeing the reduction of poverty and so on, gee, I guess, you know, what some people cannot withstand is that some people, others, make a lot more money in a good fashion, and even though they're helping society, they don't want that. So basically, apparently, they want to become equalized, even though that equalization is going to result in much lower growth and even lesser prosperity for the vast majority of the people. Now, why do we do that? I'm almost about to think that there is something in, I don't know if it's cultural, I don't know if it's genetic, that influences us to do those kind of to back those ill-conceived policies.
You quote Stanislav Andreski several times in the paper talking about this phenomenon, which he calls parasitism, which is a rather frank title for it. But you're saying that the politicians who offer parasitic policies are popular. They're getting elected.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's a fact, a historical fact, that Latin American countries have a lot more deeply rooted in our mindset this notion or this culture of dependency. And that clearly existed in the colonial era, where the Spanish crown was very rich, and therefore, well, a lot of people derived benefits from being close to the crown. And there is a stark difference between England and the colonies, particularly the 13 colonies here in America, and it's that the colonies here, they had to almost like bootstrap themselves up to prosperity because they did not depend on a wealthy crown. And right. So it seems to me like there is a historical inertia whereby this culture of dependence is a lot more ingrained among Latin Americans than among some of the former British colonies. And of course, I see with a lot of trepidation what's going on right now here in the United States, and it's that we've been implementing here a bunch of policies that are basically fostering this culture of dependency. And, you know, I say, wow, this is something similar that that happened in my country. I can't believe that, you know, we come here fleeing for those from those type of policies, and you know, we're encountering them here. I guess a major difference is, first of all, the freedom of speech that exists here, and also that we find here that there are entrepreneurial initiatives that try to defend those freedoms. And the problem with most of Latin America is that you don't find those entrepreneurs that are willing to provide funding, support, and dissemination of information that is consistent with the tenets of prosperity and welfare to everybody.
Well, let's talk about the ideological battle that's going on today, and maybe there are some optimistic notes we can find. So you talk about the university system, and describe what kind of economic philosophies predominate in the private and public universities.
Right. In public universities, you find a lot of Marxist discourse. I mean, there are courses that are on Marxism, and this is hard Marxism. Private universities basically is the Keynesian view, the one that prevails.
So that's the moderate view.
That's the moderate view, but, both of them are, they come from a central planning point of view. I mean, if we look at Keynesian models, they see the economy as a whole, and then, well, we have here a central banker and a minister of finance who knows what's the level of taxes, what's the level of government expenditure, what's the level of the money that the country needs. And so that sounds to me very much like central planning. We have also, let's say, another system which we call mercantilism, that's inspired perhaps on the writings of Adam Smith, but we now here modernly call crony capitalism. And then the problem with let's say central planning, socialism, and Keynesianism, and mercantilism is that both systems, both the central planning and the mercantilist system, well, what they have in common is their aversion to markets, because mercantilists they want to keep on making money at the expense of others by increasing the cost of living to others. And socialists, well, by definition, they don't believe in markets. And they, actually, the Keynesian presentation is like a reaction to a major market failure that the economy has experienced. So that then makes it very difficult in Latin America and in Venezuela in particular, to come up with individuals that, and I can mention names if you allow me, that are willing to basically fund, finance, dissemination of capitalism. So then you have a university system whereby students are educated in more or less central planning orientations, and then that also has, it isn't just the universities but also the media. Then the media is basically the government media, which is substantial, always has been substantial, is basically socialist. And the private media is mercantilist. So then that creates a major problem of misinformation to the average citizen. The average citizen really doesn't know that there are other alternatives, that there are other ways of doing things, that there are other things that we should require from our politicians. And then, then basically we move between extreme socialism and moderate socialism. And that's exactly what's happening right now. Right now, the opposition, if there is an election, will win it. But the opposition really has not offered anything that resembles a radical change from the socialist and mercantilist ways of us. So basically, if the opposition wins, it's not because of the merits of the plan that they're offering. It's really because of the major failure that the policies that the government has implemented and that most citizens are experiencing. So if they win and they come to power, well, the essential characteristics of our economic structure are not going to change.
You do mention a dozen or dozen and a half economists who have liberal ideas, especially at Monte Avila University.
Yeah.
So there are some people who are keeping alive good ideas. Are these relatively young faculty that you mentioned?
Yeah, basically, yeah, most of them. I mean, yeah, I would say, you know, the 42, 45 years old, the oldest one. But most of them are even younger. Yeah, yeah.
But it must be difficult for them to influence the public debate when the media is controlled.
It is very difficult. It is very difficult. I have right now a former student of mine who, unfortunately, I didn't mention him. His name is Luis Virolo. And they are, say, let's put it this way, they are trying to influence opinions through the social media, and they are in constant battle with traditional Keynesian economists that we have in Venezuela. Because, for example, right now there's a major debate whether we should dollarize or not. I mean, you know, to me that's a no-brainer, given in particular the major damages that the current system has performed on average Venezuelans. But you still have individuals educated in very good universities in the United States that basically defend a system that has totally failed us. And, well, this individual, you are in continuous contact, exchanging ideas and then trying to debate these other economists, Keynesian economists, that want to preserve the current status. So the point is that there are some individuals, most of them quite young, that do want to change the system, and in that sense, the flame of freedom, at least among them, is alive.
You also mentioned the think tank SEDICE. Can you talk about what they've done?
Yeah, they've had a very uphill battle. A very uphill battle because it isn't just against the government, but it's also that, in a sense, in some areas, they've had to compromise. They've had to compromise because they are funded by individuals like Oscar Garcia Mendoza, Rafael Alfonso. But those are not the truly, truly wealthy, super wealthy millionaires that we have in Venezuela. So in order for them to, say, survive, to have more presence, at least prior to the takeover of the media by the government, but to have presence in the media and so on, well, they also had, say, some internal battle against mercantilist entrepreneurs. But it wasn't really, you know, like a full-blown war, but it was a relationship characterized by tension, and well, in some instances, well, yeah, they had to somewhat compromise and say not live totally in accordance with classical liberal tenets. So I'm saying this, well, because, you know, it's a very difficult situation where you don't have all the economic power perhaps necessary to have your point of view being made clearly, constantly, have a television network or radio stations that can constantly disseminate these ideas of freedom, and people become then permeated by the thought and the ideals of living in a free society. So the battle, you know, that they've waged is not just against the government, but it's also a difficult battle against other entrepreneurs. I think that they have a lot of merit, and of course that's why, well, we single out persons like Rocío Guijarro, who is the general manager, and actually she's been ever so helpful and conducive to feed intellectually a lot of the professors that we mentioned today, and she has served Cedice as a whole as an inspiration to become more conversant with basically with the Austrian way of thinking, and then trying to educate their students in the Austrian way, the Austrian economic school of thought.
The two things you mentioned that were news to me and quite remarkable. One is that Hugo Chavez was known to publicly insult speakers invited by Cedice to Venezuela. And the other is that the looking for the president of the organization, Garcia Mendoza, had to leave the country and is now in the United States.
Yep, he's here in Miami. I mean, that's why I say that, you know, that he has, that we need more individuals like him. We need more individuals that has his fiber, because there were a bunch of, let's say, four or five young individuals that were and still making a lot of money, but a lot of money. And then he basically denounced what they were doing. And then as a result of that, of course, they have very powerful connections with the government. Some media outlets started then to criticize him and the bank that he led, and it's a bank that believe me, you know, everybody knows that it's the most solid bank that we have, then he started to fear for his life and the life of his family. So, incredibly enough, one of the most honest guys that we have in Venezuela, well, he had to leave. He had to bring all his family here to the United States. And, it's all a consequence of actually being an individual that is very consistent with a view of freedom, and yes, because you know, he's just being ever so consistent and trying then to defend freedom, then he's a victim of that and had to come over here.
Yeah. So I think we need to wrap up. Do you have any sort of closing thoughts about the prospects for Venezuela to turn in a more liberal direction?
Yeah. Well, I think that internally, let's put it this way, endogenously, it's going to be very, very difficult. I wish that if we could have some sort of before getting into that, I think first of all that the system as it is, we have to wait for a total breakdown if there's still space for that, and then once it has totally is totally broken, then perhaps we can restart. But a major problem that we have is the lack of leadership, and when I mean leadership, it's not only at the political level, but it's also at the entrepreneurial level. And I know that this is going to sound a little strange, but I think that if we could have the backing of, say, the United States in trying to implement, in trying to work on the economic system and not in the political system, perhaps over the long term or short term even, we may get better results. In other words, I think that the way we are is very difficult to implement the changes. But I also think that and I don't want to blame the United States on this, believe me, but I think that the strategy would have been more efficient if the United States, instead of trying to export its political system, it attempts to export its economic system. I think that we would have a Latin America more prosperous, richer Latin America, greater markets, lesser problems with immigration, and I think that that is something that we may start thinking about and see then if it's possible to basically focus more on the economic system and less on the political system. And most likely, I think that to the extent that there's prosperity as a result of focusing on the economic system, well, I mean, this is very Friedman. Once we experience one freedom, we want them all. So then we experience economic freedom, we prosper, and then we're going to ask for political liberties and civil liberties.
I guess my advice to you would be don't count on the United States government for that kind of support because they don't have a consistent understanding of free markets, but maybe the Atlas Economic Foundation can help you out. I mean, I think charitable efforts and private institutions and universities will help much more.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I hope we've brought attention to the problem, economic problems and liberty problems in Venezuela, and that will interest some people in trying to organize efforts to improve the situation.
Right. I want to thank you, and I also want to apologize because these topics are to me very close and very emotional.
No, I think that's made it very interesting. You don't need to apologize.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.